And so if you look at the seed stage venture market, it kind of peaked in that 2014, 2015 time period. But even today, there's still about 8x more seed companies funded than there was a decade ago.
Hey, what's up, everyone? Welcome back to another episode of Going Deep with Aaron Watson. Many people are intrigued or interested in the world of venture capital, and today's episode will help educate you on a little bit more about the career and what goes into it. Ned Renzi, our guest, is a founding partner at Birchmere Ventures, started here in Pittsburgh and is now expanded to an office in San Francisco. We previously interviewed partner Sean Amirati for a episode almost 2 years ago for his book, Science of Growth, which was really educational. But in this interview, we really get into the nitty gritty of the venture capital business, unlike any interview that we've done prior. Ned gets into his investing thesis, the coaching that he gives his companies in his portfolio, and what he looks for in potential investments. The stakes are high. The world of venture capital is more competitive than ever before. And you can tell how much that has sharpened Ned's eye for businesses and the metrics on which he evaluates potential startups. An absolute must listen whether or not you intend to bootstrap or fundraise in the future. You'll know more and you'll be smarter from listening to this conversation with Ned Renzi.
You're listening to Going Deep with Aaron Watson.
So, Ned, thank you so much for doing this. And
my pleasure.
I actually want to start with a statement that you made as I was prepping for this interview. You said that 99% of companies should not raise venture funding. And I think that is one of the storylines that sometimes gets confused, where it's only the companies that have raised the big round that get the celebration, mm-hmm. or maybe raising the round itself is the celebration, when that is actually more the start of a new chapter of some really hard work. So can you talk a little bit more about that statement that you made and why you have that perspective?
Of course. So if you look at the history of venture capital, it's really made to fund what we call hypergrowth companies. And when you look at the last 30 years of, say, for example, seed stage investing, most companies need to have at least a 30x return from the seed round to meet that hypergrowth potential. And very, very few companies are cut out to do that. Most are just really good EBITDA-driven companies that can grow good organically, but very few of them can do that hypergrowth mode. So for example, when Birchmere invests in companies, particularly SaaS companies, we try to achieve something we call T2D3. So you take as long as you need to get to your first million in sales. But once you get to a million, you try to triple the next 2 years. So you kind of go 1, 3, 10, just to round up, and then double the next 3 years. So then you go 20, 40, 80. So by year five, you're on 100 million run rate. Not every business can do that. And even in our portfolio, where we have 25 or 30 seed stage companies, you might only have one or two that do that. But they all kind of have to have the potential to do that if certain leaps of faith work out. If you're going into investments that just don't even have the potential to fit that criteria, they're probably not a good fit for venture capital.
Talk about the significance of that $1 million ARR level and what insights can be gleaned upon reaching that level as it comes to certain SaaS metrics like CAC and LTV and these other things. How tuned in those are?
Yeah, so we sort of look at companies logarithmically. How do you get from 0 to 1, then 1 to 10 million, and then 10 on up? And we call that 0 to 1 phase finding product market fit. And then from 1 to 10 is repeatable, scalable sales. And then from 10 million on up, I just call that the get big phase. I kind of get out of the way and let the big investors take over. And so at Birchmere, we focus on helping companies get 0 to 1 and 1 to 10. Okay. So specific to your question, in that 0 to 1 phase, it's really finding product market fit. Evidence shows, like when you look at the last sort of decade of cloud computing and SaaS companies, no matter how long it takes you to get to, say, 100K MRR, which is approximately 1 million sales, there's no real signal to whether or not you can get to 10 million after that, okay. If that makes sense. And so, for example, some companies can get to 100K MRR in 18 months, some get there in 6 months, and some may take 2, 3 years to figure it out. The question is, once you get there, sort of how fast can you get to 10 million? And so we don't see a lot of signal in how long it takes a company to get there, and then there's signal sort of after that. And that's why we focus on that 0 to 1 phase.
Now, you laid out this, you know, going from 1 to 3 million, 3 to 10, doubling to 20, 40, 80 model. Mm-hmm. And for someone who's unfamiliar with venture in general, that rate of growth can be intimidating to try and accomplish. So can you maybe speak to why that rate of growth, I know there's historical precedence for it, but like why that has been such an important metric for you to push companies to pursue?
Yeah, so the most important reason is on a relative basis to peer companies that are also going after venture funding. And so if you look at the seed stage venture market, it kind of peaked in that 2014, 2015 time period. But even today, there's still about 8x more seed companies funded than there was a decade ago. And if there's 8x more seed companies funded, when you look ahead to the Series A, there's virtually the same number of Series A and Series B rounds getting done. Now, more money's going into those A and B rounds, but the same actual number of deals are getting done. So you have 8x more companies competing for the same Series A dollars. And so if you're not in the top decile of metrics in the seed round, then you're not going to raise a Series A. And so to get in the top decile, there's a handful of statistics we look at, and you know, the lifetime value relative cost of customer acquisition, LTV to CAC you had mentioned, there's churn rates, there's growth rates, you know, there's relative new book business versus sales and marketing efficiency. There's just sort of a set of benchmarks and metrics Birchmere builds these dashboards and we help manage our companies by, with the idea that they'll be the most attractive to raise Series A financings.
That makes sense. As you've honed this skill set, you've been at Birchmere now for a while, and the skill set to not only be able to get those numbers, to analyze them, start to have a sense of where things are going, but to also understand the jockey who's riding this company. Can you talk a little bit about the relationship between those two? Because I think that there's, you know, if you listen to other investors talk, or just some people's personality skews maybe more data driven versus more like gut person driven, where you fall and how you maybe balance those two, because you've spoken to the importance of that data, but I know that the person is also a big part of that equation.
Yeah. So when you invest at the seed stage, you really don't have a lot of data to go on. So you're really betting on a couple things. One is, you know, that there's a big market out there, and we look for founders that we have what we call problem founder fit. And the idea is, if you have somebody who's trying to solve a problem for themselves, or working in an area where they have unique knowledge, then they're going to figure out how to capture or capitalize on that large market opportunity. And so we're really looking for that fit to begin with. And then we're looking for things like grit, persistence, and sort of like a lot of these intangible things that make it hard. You're going to go through, as an entrepreneur, you're going to go through periods where you're going to miss payroll, you're going to miss numbers, you're going to, I mean, we've had situations where founders have moved back in with their parents, and there's all kinds of, like, it's an emotional roller coaster, it's a very lonely place, and you just need to have people who have the grit and persistence and resiliency and things to rise above it. Those are largely almost impossible to quantify, but we sort of look for signals in the past. You know, we've had a lot of good success with people who, you know, were really, really number one at whatever they did in the past, whether it was in the classroom, whether it was in sports, whether it was in the military and different things like that. We're just sort of looking for performers along some high dimension. And then we try to focus on that. And so even within Birchmere, I of all the partners probably put most emphasis on that problem founder fit and betting on the team. And then we have other partners who are sort of much more focused on the analytics and data. And I think it's just sort of that group dynamic that sort of balances the two, that helps us as a firm make the right decisions.
So another interesting part of a venture capital firm is that there are these different partners who are coming in from their meetings and bringing a deal in and maybe leading a deal, so to speak. You've led deals in the past like Cvent, and that dynamic of when the partners sit down to, as much as you can disclose, what does that dynamic look like when maybe there's inevitably a disagreement or some different point of view in terms of what you prioritize versus another partner?
Sure. So I talked a little bit about what I prioritize. So I'll focus on the first part of that question. So in general, Birchmere works on a unanimous basis. We have three investing partners. All three have to vote to make an investment in a particular space. What we found, though, over time is, you know, sometimes one partner has a unique view that the other partners don't have on an entrepreneur, on a market, on something, that sometimes that needs to override the majority rules. And so I'd say we're probably a little softer on that than we used to be in terms of you know, having the, you know, 3-0 type vote. But along the way, it's a very stage gated process. So when, you know, if I sourced a deal and I brought it into a partner meeting and I presented it to everybody, I try to find out what the concerns are up front. And just like when an entrepreneur, you know, uses a market map and sort of figures out which leaps of faith are the biggest risks in the business, we do the same from an investment standpoint. So if I know, you know, one of my partners has a big concern on market size or a big concern on the technology or something, I'll address those parts of due diligence first, come back a week or two later. And if they're not comfortable with it, then I try to figure out, is there a path to getting comfortable? Or is this something that, you know, are they going to like not block a deal and sort of go along with that discomfort? Or if I overcome it, then I move to the next objection. And sort of by the time we get to the point of an entrepreneur coming in presenting to all the partners, I've either overcome most or all of those objections, or they're at least at a point where they have enough data and maybe we just disagree on the facts, and then they have to decide if they're going to block that deal or support that deal.
That makes sense. So one of the other kind of storylines that I hear just kind of going around Pittsburgh, and I've heard some dissenting voices against this, is the notion of the Valley of Death. So you have Innovation Works, you have a number of like the small seed stage investments. Mm-hmm. And then the next level of investment, the storyline is we can't find that or we can't get that here in Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. So we either have to go someone else or it just isn't there. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, a couple weeks ago, I was at the Duolingo office and mm-hmm. Louis Von Ahn said basically that mm-hmm. if you've got something really good, like I've never found that it's an issue mm-hmm. to find capital if your stuff is really, really good. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's just like a degree of, you know, insensitivity and be like, you're just not good enough to earn that capital. Yeah, yeah. But as someone who's seeing as many deals as probably anyone in the city, what is your perspective on that notion that there is this valley of death in terms of finding capital in Pittsburgh?
Yeah, to me, it's sort of a nuanced approach. And to sort of take Louis' side, because I think he made a very valid point, is, you know, I've been in Pittsburgh doing seed investing for 20 years. I can't say I've seen a great idea go unfunded because of that valley of death. Now, the unfortunate thing is sometimes those companies have to move to raise capital, but I've never seen a great idea, a great team not get funded because of that. So I tend to side with Louis' perspective on that. With that said, because Birchmere invests across the country, there are certain geographies where it's definitely much easier to raise capital than other geographies. The relative valuations, the recruiting advantages, disadvantages, the ability to get early adopter customers. And so when I sort of look at things like the Valley of Death, one of the big challenges in this region is we don't have a lot of early adopter customers. A lot of our companies that start in Pittsburgh have to go to the coast to get their first 10 to 50 customers.
That makes sense. As you alluded to, you've opened up an office in San Francisco, and one of the other sides of venture is the competition to get into deals sometimes, mm-hmm. which is, you know, you have these startups who are looking for funding, looking for that next level up, but you're also competing with other venture firms that might want to get into a deal on one of those really great ideas, those competitive startups. So talk to me about how you, as a company, think about competition, mm-hmm. Both regionally in Pittsburgh, and then mm-hmm. as you're branching out to other markets, how that plays out.
Yeah, you know, so like a lot of entrepreneurs, or my advice to entrepreneurs is, at Birchmere, we don't obsess over the competition. You know, there's certain geographies in the U.S. are certainly more competitive than other geographies, but I'm kidding myself if I think I'm going to go into San Francisco and win deals on my personal reputation or Birchmere's brand or something like that. Generally, the investments we've made in the Bay Area have been relationships where we had prior relationships, where students were undergrad or grad students we had at Carnegie Mellon, or entrepreneurs we had funded in the past, or referrals from entrepreneurs we had funded in the past. And so, you know, when we look at investment opportunities in other regions, San Francisco as well as others, we have to say, why are we the lucky guys, right? Why aren't the local firms funding them? And so we tend to have a unique relationship with the company or the founders through another avenue before that. These aren't just like cold calls coming in and things like that. And I'd say somewhat similar for Pittsburgh. I mean, there's not a whole lot of groups that do seed investing in the mid-Atlantic period, let alone Pittsburgh. And so I would say, you know, in the Pittsburgh and mid-Atlantic region, Midwest regions, there's generally a more collaborative approach with seed fundings. We have a lot of co-investors. You're not really, not in a lot of competitive term sheet situations, not getting cut back on deals. Now, in Silicon Valley, just because of some of the relationships, we've gotten into some very high profile deals in the Bay Area. But if those tend to be very competitive, we've gotten cutting back in those deals. So instead of investing our normal 750, maybe we only get 500 or 400K or something like that in the deal, but we haven't been getting cut out totally.
Is 750 the standard deal size? Because when I was looking at the website, I saw 250 million under management and just over 50 investments. So that math told me it's 5 million per deal. How does that work?
Yeah, so a couple things. First of all, we manage multiple funds. So that 250 encapsulates all five of our venture funds. Okay. And on average, they're about 50 million in size.
Okay.
And so my investment numbers that I'm quoting is our initial investment.
Right.
So in a fund, the current fund's about $50 million. We'll have 30 companies in that. Each initial investment is approximately 750K. And then if you look at just the numbers in seed stage venture, around 30% of those will go on to raise a Series A, and another half of those will go on to raise a Series B. We only do follow-ons in those companies that are succeeding. So we start with 750, and our goal is that in the last great day to have about half of our investable capital in the top 5 to 7 companies.
Makes sense. In terms of the expertise of Birchmere, we talked a little bit about deal size. We talked about the SaaS orientation. Mm-hmm. Are there any other specific domains in which you find yourself either having a leg up, having an expertise, or mm-hmm. also just getting particularly excited about?
Yeah. So in terms of having a leg up, where we've had the most investment success is in SaaS companies and marketplaces. And we've been lucky enough to have a couple public offerings at north of $1 billion and several more multi-hundred million dollar exits in those sectors. And so those tend to be the sectors that we focus on the most. In terms of technologies, you know, we are very horizontal investors. So we focus on, these business models like SaaS and marketplaces, but in any vertical market. And then we take looks at technologies that we think are inevitable in different areas like machine vision, artificial intelligence. And then and we try to think, how are those going to win in markets? And we build out these market maps. And for example, in something like machine learning, we think there's going to be a very vertically approached the winners will be very vertically market focused, right? So if you're building machine learning, before you get to general AI, you're going to have vertical AI for legal, for education, for healthcare, for these other vertical markets. So we have 4 or 5 investments in that space, but they're very vertically focused. We also have 3 or 4 seemingly so far very successful investments in autonomous vehicle related technologies. And again, we sort of took a view that the winners were determined from an equipment standpoint. Like, we're not going to build or fund the next Tesla or on the ride sharing, the next Uber. But if you looked at the value chain and the stack, there were certain things like certain ways to do machine readable maps at a very low cost were not done. You know, things like we think turn by turn navigation was not very well done. And we thought some of these technologies could be leapfrogged with more real time info to help people get routed and get through traffic a lot faster. So most of our investments in that space have been, you know, parts of the value chain where we saw big gaps.
So one of the common themes of this show has been the importance of the personal connections, and you've alluded to how that got you into some deals in San Francisco and elsewhere. As you find this interest, in terms of inbound versus outbound connecting or getting in the rooms with certain people, I'm sure you have a fair amount of inbound and people passing them along your way, but whether it's as a guest lecturer at Carnegie Mellon or just talk to some of the other strategies that you employ to put yourself out there and go find what is happening on the ground or specifically network your way into a company in one of these domains.
Sure. So we've done all of the above. So if I sort of look at it, you know, we have one investment in particular where Birchmere or some of our companies were using a product that they thought was great and was a kind of game changing in the sort of enterprise sales and marketing area. And that was a case where we went outbound, reached out to that company. We thought they were the best company in the space. We thought the future was inevitable. We really liked that team. And we got ourselves into that deal just through sheer hard work and inbound. Like a lot of other venture funds, we do a lot of work at accelerators, universities. So we all like guest lecture, do office hours at a number of these universities. Accelerators are an interesting trend because there's a big bifurcation in performance. So there's some accelerators locally, like Alpha Lab Gear, where we do office hours. And then we cover certain geographies, like I cover Seattle to Los Angeles for Birchmere. So a number of the accelerators, Seattle, Portland, a few in the Bay Area, and then in Southern California. And those have also, generated pretty significant deal flow. And then we also try to leverage, you know, some of these relationship advantages we have. So, for example, out in the Bay Area, I run this networking group of VCs who are from Pittsburgh or went through Pittsburgh at Carnegie Mellon. We get together a couple times a year. The good news for me is almost all of them are growth stage investors. And so I build these relationships with them that when they see entrepreneurs or teams they really like, but the deals are too small or too early for them, they're willing to show those deals and share those deals with us with the idea they get to sort of first look at it when those companies are ready for the Series A. And they know how active we are on boards. They know how we work with metrics and dashboards and how we prepare companies for those A rounds. So they know we'll get them ready for funds like themselves. And so we actually get a fair amount of inbound from relationships like that. And I do that in the West Coast. I have partners who do that in the East Coast and the Midwest as well.
What does your travel schedule look like on a day-to-day, week-to-week basis?
So I'd probably answer that more on a monthly basis. Okay. So I have a house in the Bay Area. I fly to the Bay Area once a month. Sometimes I stay 1 week, sometimes I stay 3 weeks, depending on what's happening out there. So I'd like to say my travel schedule isn't bad because it's kind of point to point for the most part and kind of once a month. I just happen to stay there a long time when I'm there, which is way better than 5 or 7 years ago. Before we had the office out there, and I was flying back and forth doing red eyes 2, 3, 4 times a month. Those days are kind of over. Some of my partners who cover more of the cities on the East Coast do tend to travel a lot more. They have a lot more day trips to New York, day trips to DC, day trips to Florida, and things like that.
In terms of some of these relationships, you talked about the growth stage investors who might be, you know, looking at the next stage of a deal that comes through you. There's the accelerators, there's the universities. Talk about the importance of maybe angel investors who are also at that seed stage level who would partner on deals with you and how frequently that type of situation happens.
Yeah, I'd say most of the investments we make, we do co-invest with angel investors. I'd say most of them have had angel, maybe like 70-80% have had angel money or Innovation Works money or something before Birchmere's invested. And then some, you know, angels, a very generic term that, you know, has a wide span, yeah. Right?
So there are a lot super of angels. You got your,
that's right. Yeah. So there's a lot of angels in the Bay Area that do 6 and 7 figure checks. And so some of the angel investors we deal with are sort of almost like their own micro VCs.
Absolutely. We're going to aim towards wrapping up here, but one of the last things I wanted to talk about is maybe just, you know, as someone who's been on the ground in Pittsburgh for a while, what you've seen evolutionarily in terms of the interest in the startup scene, the depth of the startup scene, and how important it is to you. I mean, you grew up in Murraysville, you've set up shop here in Pittsburgh, how important that is to you.
Yeah, so it's very important to me. And I'd say Pittsburgh ecosystems changed dramatically for the positive. So when I moved here 20 years ago, you know, there was sort of some individual large successes in Pittsburgh. You know, I think Four Systems was one of the first big tech successes. And then we had Free Markets and more recently iGate and things like that. And there were a number of small spinoffs, but then some things happened in the macro economy that sort of stunted that potential. And then some really big opportunities like BeFree and Lycos actually had left Pittsburgh. What we're seeing now is, you know, Google has, I think, their second biggest engineering office outside of Mountain View here. So 700-800 people. Uber's sort of in that same range. I think Amazon's acquired 3 or 4 companies and growing an office here. And so in addition to Carnegie Mellon upping their game and getting, you know, more entrepreneurship-focused students and faculty, you have all this critical mass of the ecosystem. We're starting to see the corporates become early adopters of technology in some of our companies that we hadn't seen. So as of today, I'm more bullish about the future of Pittsburgh than I ever have been. I'd say with that said, coming back to this logarithmic way to look at companies, you know, my experience is Pittsburgh companies never lose on science or engineering. Our scientists and engineers are just as good as Stanford or Berkeley or MIT. You know, the smartest people don't go to just 3 or 4 schools in the country. And we have a lot of really smart people here. And that can get a company that 0 to 1 phase and a lot of the way to that 1 to 10 phase. But once you get above 10 million and you start raising growth capital and you start having to hire hundreds of people in non-technical fields, product management, product marketing, sales, BD. And then in general, you know, you're recruiting people to a region. They say, hey, if this startup doesn't work out, what else can I do? You know, am I going to pull my kids out of middle school and move them across the country? If this doesn't work, there's only 5 other growth stage companies or 3 other ones, right? And so that's still a challenge for Pittsburgh. We need a couple more successes to snowball to build that critical mass of talent for the next phase of scaling the companies. I know at Birchmere, we do something we call geographically optimizing companies. And in some cases where we feel that's a challenge at the earliest stage, we'll open an office in another city to recruit that outward facing talent. Maybe it's New York, maybe it's Boston, maybe it's the Bay Area. And then conversely, we do the geographic optimization in the other direction. Like right now, I'm on the board of a company in the Bay Area that just raised a large Series D round. We don't need to be paying $70 a square foot for, you know, bookkeeping and finance and customer service. So we opened a back office in Salt Lake City in that case, and we sort of geographically optimized in the opposite direction.
Also, it seems like just the prevalence of remote work and what that enables companies to do from a cost standpoint has also really exploded in your time as a VC.
I think that's right. I think that's there's just a few macro trends on cloud computing, the cost of storage, you know, things like you're talking about with the ability to telecommute and travel and things. Yeah, it's totally changed the game.
Awesome. Well, this has been great. You've had some killer answers for us. And as we aim towards wrapping up, before we ask our last two questions, is there anything else you were hoping to talk about today that I didn't give you a chance to?
No, I think you probably checked out my blog post, but it's still morning in Pittsburgh. I think Pittsburgh's at the beginning of a good 10-year run. I sort of look at where the world's going from a technology standpoint and a couple key technologies that you alluded on, whether they're autonomous vehicles, artificial intelligence, machine learning, natural language programming. And if you map that to the region's core competencies, and particularly what Carnegie Mellon's good at, I think Carnegie Mellon's actually one or two in almost every one of those categories, above Stanford, above MIT, and things like that. So I'm very, very bullish about the future for that reason.
Awesome. I am as well. And I really appreciate you for the work that you're doing for the region and for taking the time with us today. If people are going to want to connect with you and learn more, where can we point them to in the digital world to do so?
Yeah, I mean, by email, ned@birchmerevc.com, and on Twitter @NedRenzi.
Awesome. We'll link that in the show notes. goingdeepwitharon.com/podcast is going to be the place to find it for this and every episode of the show. But as we do at the end of each interview, Ned, I want to give you the mic one final time to issue a actionable personal challenge for the audience.
An actionable personal challenge. I think for those out there who know me, one of the things I do is a lot of personal experimenting. And what I'm messing around with right now is intermittent fasting. And so I'm sort of doing a daily 15-hour fast and one 24-hour fast once a month. And I try to make those on my cross-country trips. So it's easy to avoid bad decisions in airport food. So I sort of feel like I get a double benefit. But as you study that, there's a lot of benefits to fasting. But it's a real mental game that, you know, to overcome that first pang of hunger and the second one. And as you study it, you realize the amplitude 2 hours out, you know, you get hungry. And if you wait that out, 2 hours later, you'll get another one, but the amplitude's lower and lower. And it was completely surprising to me that, you know, 12, 14, 20 hours later, you're actually less hungry than I was in the first 2 hours. And once you know that mentally, then it makes it a lot easier in the future.
So I played Ultimate Frisbee at Pitt, and like during one of the seasons, I kind of told my teammates that I was going to do it, and they freaked out. Yeah, they're like, that is a terrible idea. Yeah. You're going to submarine the team. And I had a very, very similar experience where it's like, yeah, at first you're like, your body's used to eating breakfast. That's so right. It's like, where's the food?
Yeah.
Hey, we still haven't gotten food yet. And then at some point it just kind of figures out that that's what works.
Yeah, actually that your body trains itself to burn fat as a fuel instead of looking for available carbs.
Yeah.
And in the long run, it seems like a lot healthier.
So what are any other experiments that you've run on yourself recently?
I've run a lot on personal productivity in terms of, you know, waking up without an alarm clock. I found my best deep thinking was in the mornings. And so I've moved to a schedule of what I call maker time, manager time. And maker time is completely uninterrupted. So I look at my two or three hardest tasks for the day. I schedule nothing before noon. Like today, this is my first meeting. And in the morning, I get my two or three most important things done in the day before my day kind of gets away from me, but also do my deepest work while my brain's the freshest. And then I do sort of more reactive, passive work, things like this interview, phone calls, emails, and things like that in the middle part of the day. Then I do a huge espresso hit in the afternoon, and then I have a run with my West Coast companies in the evening.
Nice. Yep. Well, it seems like that also pairs nicely with the intermittent fasting, because if you're getting your main things done and then you like reward yourself with food after that also reinforces the behavior loop.
It's actually worked well. So yeah, good point.
Cool. Well, Ned, thank you so much for coming on. All right. We just went deep with Ned Renzi. Hope everyone out there has a fantastic day.
Thank you.
Hey, thank you so much for listening to another episode of Going Deep with Aaron Watson. Please hit that subscribe button if you've not already done so. We have some fantastic episodes coming down the pipe, including one with startup founder Ryan Green. with deep thinker Michael Skirpin, and with Search Fund founder Jamie Van Buren, plus many more great episodes coming down the pipe. If you are at all interested in building an Instagram account with impact and influence, then you need to get a ticket for our April 12th Instagram Influencer Workshop at Alloy 26. Event links are easily found on Facebook or Eventbrite or on our website at pipercreative.co/events. We are bringing in some of the biggest accounts in the city to talk about how they've grown their followings, what they've learned about photography, and how you can do the same. We hope to see you there, and I hope that you'll listen to the next episode of Going Deep with Aaron Watson. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. Connect with Aaron on Twitter and Instagram at AaronWatson59.